We're on Daf Kuf Yudbeis Amud Aleph. Sounds familiar, hopefully. Okay. So Tana Rabbanan, about five lines up from the bottom. We learned in a Braisa. Now, up until now, what we've been discussing is the case of Yorshim that inherited a cow from their father. And there were different cases. There was a stolen cow, there was a rented cow, a barred cow, and then we had a long discussion about the difference between Gzela and She'ela with regard to Kimle B'Rabamine. We had a case, for example, of someone who stole a cow on Shabbos. If he stole a cow on Shabbos through Meleches Hotzah, then he should be potter because of Kimle B'Rabamine, but we said that in that case, as far as Knas is concerned, we don't apply the principle of Kim Levi the Rabbinate to Knas. But the only thing is that if he stole it on Shabbos, then the Gneva itself, meaning the Keren, would be obligatory. The Keren itself would be knocked off because of Kim Levi the Rabbinate. And then if he shechted the cow, he would be potter from Dal Vehei, even though Knas, generally speaking, does not lend itself to the Patur of Kimle B'Rabbinei, but here he's potter from Kimle B'Rabbinei on the Keren, and therefore he's potter on the Dal Vehei. But if he stole the cow on Erev Shabbos, so the Chiyuv Keren is already set in stone, and then he shechts it on Shabbos, in such a case he will be chayav to pay Dalet Vehei because Dalet Vehei is a knas and there's no Kimle B'Rabbinei on knas. If on the other hand the para was a borrowed para and he shechted it on Shabbos, in such a case that's a maisa gzela, that's called stealing the cow, and in a case of stealing the cow we have a chiv keren, there's no Dalet Vehei, and we apply the principle of Kimle B'Rabbinei. So that was the sugya that we did last time we got together, which was on Tuesday, right, on Yom Ha'atzmaut. Tana Rabbanan, now we have a Braisa. The Braisa tells us the following. V'heishiv es ha'gzela asher gazal. Ma tamid lomer. Why does it have to add the words asher gazal? Those two words are superfluous. It could have said v'heishiv es ha'gzela. We would understand on our own that it's asher gazal. Asher gozal yachzir ke'ein shegozal. What this means is that if the gzela is still intact, the object, then there's a chiyuv of hashav. Veishim zay gzela shegozal. It's ke'ein shegozal. However, if the gzela, the object that was stolen, doesn't exist anymore, it's been destroyed or it's been eaten, then what do we do with this pasuk? Asher gozal. After all, we know that the gazlan himself, in a case where the object is lost or stolen, has to pay damim. And here we're getting some sort of an exclusion, a mute, that if it's not kein shegozal, there's no chiyuv hashava. So how do we understand this exemption from hashava? Again, let's go over this. If the gazlan stole it, then mimonavshach. If the object is still intact, then he has to return the object. If the object is destroyed, then he has to return its damim, its value. So when are we, in what circumstance are we excluding from the pasuk of asher gozal, kein shegozal, the chiyuv hashava? Mikan amru, this is what the chachamim derive from this pasuk, kein shegozal, hagozel machil es bonav pturim milishalim. What that means is that if the Yorshim destroy the object, then there's a Chiv Damim for the Gazlan, but there's no Chiv Damim on the Yorshim. They didn't steal the object, they don't have a Chiv Damim. But now the Braisa wants to know what happens if the Gzela is still intact. That's called Hiniach Lifnehem, means the father left after his death the Gzela in front of the Yarshim. They have now possession over the Gzela. And the question is, in such a case, there's a Chiyuv Hashava. But the only problem is, what if these Yarshim are Ketanim, are children? So So here the Brisa records a machlokus between Simchus and the Chachamim. According to the Chachamim, Bein Gdolim, Bein Ketanim, even though the Yorshim are Ketanim, nevertheless Chayovim. And we'll have to understand what this is all about, because normally we have a principle that you cannot bring a cotton into Bezdin. And moreover, you cannot even testify against the cotton. So if that be the case, why did the Chacham say that if it's Ke'en Shegazal, meaning the object is still intact, then you collect the object from the Yorshim, even though the Ketanim, Mishum Sumchus Amru Gdolim Chayovim, Ketanim Pturim, it means that according to Sumchus, we're going to apply the general rule that you cannot sue a katan in Bezdin. He's not a litigant that has to show up in Bezdin. And even if he would show up in Bezdin, you cannot testify against him. And therefore, how would the Nigzal be able to successfully force the katan in this case to return the gzela, the object that was stolen, even if it's still intact? In other words, it would seem that the Nigzal has no choice but to wait until the heirs of the gazlan become gdolim, and only then can he get his object, his stolen object, back, according to Sufis. But as long as these children are ktanim, then there's no possibility of the Nigzal getting back his Chefetz HaGozel. That's the sheet of whom? Of Sumchus. Now, what I'd like to learn with you for a moment is a footnote here, which I photocopied. Again, there may not be enough. I didn't make enough copies, I don't know. But it's footnote number Lamed Dalet. Just make sure you don't turn it upside down, because if you turn it upside down, you won't find Lamed Dalet. All right? Because we'll get to another footnote later on. So again, that's only for someone who likes to see it inside. If you don't like to see it inside, that's fine. I have a participant in my morning shiur, 9 o'clock shiur, who has a photographic memory. So he looks at it, and that's it. He doesn't have to see it after that.
Where did you buy one of those?
What'd you say?
Where did you buy a photographic memory?
Yeah, I don't know. He seems to have a very exclusive copyright on it. He doesn't want to sell it. Okay, so why does Sumchus insist that the Nigzal has no recourse to get his object back from the Katan? So he says here, first quoting Rashi, that Lefi She'ein Mekablim Edus Shelo Bifnei Baldin. The Katan Kimi She'eino Lefaneinu Hu Kimavur Lahalan Bigmar. So he's already anticipating what's coming around the bend. In just a few lines, we're going to have a whole discussion about the fact that a katan is not considered a baldin, and that there's a precondition in Edus that Edus always has to be testified in the presence of the baldin, the one who stands to lose, in this case obviously the katan, and he is not considered a baldin. So we understand Sumchus, and this is Rashi and Tosfos, but the Rashba has something to say about this. The Gemara later on, we'll get to it in Mirtz Hashem today, says that this rule of Ein Mekablim Edus El Bifnei Baal Din is not a hardcore absolute rule. It has exceptions. And it only applies when it's feasible to have the Edim testify in front of the Baal Din, in event that it becomes impossible for the Edim to testify in front of the Baal Din, the Edus will be accepted even Shelo Bifnei Baal Din. And the Gemara is going to have a whole slew of scenarios. But let's just take one scenario to make life easier for ourselves. Let's say the Baal Din is off in Medina Sayam. He can't be found. He can't be communicated with. And now the Tovea needs to get his Edim and testify against the Nitba. But the Nitba is nowhere to be found. In that case, and many other similar cases that we'll get to in just a few minutes, so be patient, the Beis Din will accept the Edus, despite the fact that Nitba is not here. Now, in the case of a Katan, at the face of it, and that's what the Rashba is bothered by, that's an impossible situation, because since the Katan cannot be what? Considered a Baal Din, there's no possibility of being made in front of the Baal Din, because there is no Baal Din as far as the Kabbalah's Edus is concerned. In that case, we should drop the requirement of Bifnei Baal Din. So again, since the Gemara is flexible and it's not an absolute hardcore rule, then whenever it's impossible to get the Baal Din into Beis Din, will be made Shelo Bifnei Baal Din. And for example, let's say in dramatizing it, let's say this Katan who inherited the gzela from his father is all of one day old, we're going to have to wait a full 13 years in order to reclaim, for the nigzel to reclaim his gzela. Says the Rashba, ein lecha hefse gadol mizeh. And therefore the Rashba doesn't understand how the Gemara, according to the way we saw in Rashi and Tosus, applies the principle here in the case of Katan, ein mekablin edus, that it's a problem of Kabbalah's edus. And this leads us to another interpretation, that of the Nebuki Yosef. The Nebuki Yosef offers an alternative. And he says the following, that in all the cases that we're going to have, that we drop the requirement of Lifnei Baal Din, those are all cases where, from the perspective of the Eidus, it's possible that the Eidus could be Bifnei Baal Din. We have technical barriers in our way, but at least if we look at the Eidus in abstract, it lends itself to Eidus Bifanov. So even though Bifal, in actuality, the Eidus was Shalom Bifanov, but at least it was Eidus Shenitenes Ureuil Bifanov. I'll explain. But he says in the case of Katan, now we have a situation where it's legally, according to Halacha, impossible for the Eidus itself to be Bifanov. What the Rashba, I'm sorry, the Muki Yosef means to say is that the halacha always differentiates between two different scenarios. One scenario is where it's absolutely impossible. The other scenario is possible, but right now we have a technical, what we call a temporary blockage. Now, let's understand, for example, you have the case of someone who's very far from Beis Din, and he wants to testify in front of Beis Din. So today maybe we would find different technological innovations for such a person. But back in the day, he had only one option in such a case, to sign an affidavit and send it into Beis Din by mail. That's called an igeres. Rabbeinu Tam says that that's okay, and that edus is acceptable. Says Rabbeinu Tam, the Gemara says that al pishnayim edim yakum davar, is the, and then the pasuk says v'im lo yagid v'nosavono, that you need hagada b'fnei Beis Din. Says Rabbeinu Tam, that only excludes an ilev who doesn't have the capacity to speak in front of Beis Din. But if you have a person who has the possibility of speaking, just that for technical reasons he cannot testify, and therefore the gavra is not possible for edus, then we can accept his edus in writing. I'm only, again, this is a sugya unto itself, but I'm only using this as a lisaber to ozen, that sometimes the halacha says, this is based on a sugya menachos. The principle is called a roi lebila ein bila makevispo. But kisha ain't a roi lebila, then bila makevispo. Here also, according to the Muki Yosef, the case of a katan, he's considered eino roi lios baal din. There's a halachic status, like similar to that of an ilam, according to Rabbeinu Tam, that he al pi din is mufka, he's not a gadol for Kabbalah's edus, so therefore he's excluded. Masha Henkin and all the other cases where there is a possibility of giving edus in front of the baal din, just that there's a technical blockage because the Baal Din is off in China, or he's very ill and he can't get out of bed, and so forth and so on. In all those cases, the Eidus lends itself to being Eidus Bifnei Baal Din. But if there is no Baal Din, meaning halachically the person has a status which makes him excluded from being a Baal Din, in such a case, says the Muki Yosef, the Eidus becomes an impossible Eidus. In other words, the Muki Yosef says there's a psul in Eidus of Eidus Shalom Bifnei Baal Din, and we're going to waive that psul in a case where the Eidus lends itself to Bifnei Baal Din, but for technical and logistical reasons, the Eidim can't testify in front of the Baal Din. But if there's a legal halakhic reason why it can't be Bifnei Baal Din, because in this case the Baal Din is whom? Is a Katan. In such a case, that's a psul in the Eidus itself, because the Eidus cannot be Bifnei Baal Din. And this is the way that Nebuki Yosef presents the underlying reasoning of Sumchus, that in this case, we cannot possibly be Tovea the Katan, and to the dismay of the Nigzal, he's going to have to wait possibly as much as 13 years to get back his Chefetz HaNigzal. But the other Rishonim before the Rashba came along, they were of the opinion that simply there's some sort of absolute rule of Ein Mekablim Eidus Shelo B'fnei Baal Din. And later on, we're going to have the Gemara with all the exceptions. We're going to have to interpret that according to Rashi and Tosfos. So that remains an outstanding question. Now, since we mentioned the Rashba, and the Rashba was very dissatisfied with the presentation of Tosfos, the Rashba now has to offer an alternative presentation. What is then the machlokas here between Sumchus and the Chacham? And that you'll see in the next paragraph here. He says the following, that machlokes sumchus v'chachamim is how to interpret the pasuk. Later on Daf Kuf Yud Beis Amid Beis, the Gemara is going to derive this requirement of Bifnei Baal Din from the case of a shara hamuad shaharag es ha'odam. The halacha is that if a shar is a killer shar, that means it killed a human being, eventually we're going to put the shar to death. But we have to warn the Bailim on three different occasions. And Edom have to come into Bezdin and testify about this particular ox, that this ox is a dangerous ox. And it has to have to once, twice, thrice. On every single occasion, the Torah requires that the owner of the shar be present in Bezdin at the time of the Edus. Because it says, "V'huad bibba'olav, ad she'abaylim lefana, lefne'abaylim." The Rashba says that according to the Chachamim, that requirement of bifnei baal din, since it's derived from a shara muad, is limited to dinei nefashos. In halacha, we distinguish between two types of judgments in court. And it's a fundamental distinction that goes right to the core of Masechta Sanhedrin and all of Nezikin. There's Dine Nefashos and Dine Mamonos. Now, it might surprise you to find out, if you don't know this, that Shar Amud, in the case of a Shar that kills a human being, and now the Shar is, so to speak, on trial, and the question is whether we put the Shar to death, that's classified as what? Dine Nefashos. It might surprise you. And the reason for that is because there's a halachic principle that Kemisasa shall bailim kach misasa shall shar. For example, in Dine Mamonos, how many judges do we need on a court? 3. In Dine Nefashos, we need a minimum of 23. So in the case of a shar ha-muad, and we want to know whether he's chayv skila or not, that's going to require 23 judges. And that might surprise you, but that's defined as Dine Nefashos. Says the Rashba, Chachamim say that this requirement in Dine Nefashos that we derive from Shara Muad, that it's got to be Bifnei Bailim, that cannot be extended to Dine Mamonos. So according to the Shita of the Chachamim, the Rashba claims, whenever you see Ein Mekablim Eidus El Bifnei Baal Din, that's going to be a Dine Nefashos case. Now, it could very well be, as we'll soon see later, that we might apply, even according to Chacham, the requirement of Difnei Baal Din to Dine Mamonos as well, but that's only Durabbanan. And if it's only Durabbanan, then we're going to find all sorts of kulos, and that's where the Chachamim say that we can testify against this katan in order to return the object that was stolen to its rightful owner. The Rush, on the other hand, says that the halacha here is a halacha in gzela. And he says that only in gzela, if the gzela is still in existence, then the chachamim say that mekablim edus shelo bifnei baal din. So it comes out like this, that according to the Rashba, the chachamim maintain that the entire requirement of edus bifnei baal din is limited to what? Dine nefash. So according to the Rosh, even the Chachamim would expand the requirement of Fnei Baal Din to any Eidus, even Eidus of Mamonos. But there's one exception. In one case, we're going to allow for Eidim to testify Shalov Fnei Baal Din. And that's the case of Gzeil. In other words, the Rosh learns that this drasha that we're learning here in this Braisa is not a miut, but on the contrary, it's a ribui. It's coming to tell me that the exception to the rule of Bifnei, of the requirement of Bifnei Baal Din, is the case of Gzeil. The Torah has tremendous identity, or identification, I should say, with a nigzal, in order to return the object that's rightfully his to the Nigzal. And the Torah, for the sake of returning the Gzeil to the Nigzal, is going to is going to alleviate, is going to relieve the edim of the requirement of edus bifnei baldin. Now I was thinking the following. It's very nice if you're giving a drasha on Shabbos before Musaf to say, well, the Torah wants to be compassionate in the case of an exile to allow facilitators returning his object. It's nice. I can give a whole drasha about the terrible things of a Gazlan and how we have to, you know, we have to avoid all these scandals that are going on in the world. It's good for a drasha, but I don't think it's correct. And I'll tell you why. Because what about the case of a malva and a lova? Do we have no compassion for a malva to get back his money and the lova is nowhere to be found? Or the lova is a katan and here we're going to apply, according to the Rush, the requirement of bifnei, you know, wait 13 years till he becomes a gadol. We have no compassion for the poor malva who did a great mitzvah. He extended a tremendous amount of money. And no, go wait 13 years. And what about the case of a nizak? Somebody deliberately damaged his sada. You know, he lost parnasa for a year. I mean, that we wait 13 years because the guy who did it was a cut. I don't get it. Perhaps what the Rush has in mind is the following: that the only claim to this object that requires edus is Yerusha, meaning the following. Why is this cotton in the ballpark? Who invited him? Who needs him? The answer is, he inherited from his father. And there's a new halacha over here, that when you inherit something from your father, it's the whole kit and caboodle. It's all or nothing. Or akol or lo klum, as we say. In other words, every single piece of property that's in the estate, whether it's metaltolin, whether it's karkos, whatever it might be, automatically transfers over to the yarshim. But there's one exception, and that's gzela. Because gzela doesn't even belong to his father. He illegally usurped the object, took possession of the object. That possession, what we call chazaka, is not recognized by the halacha. That's an illegal chazakah. So what we're going to do is we're going to undermine the chazakah of the father on gzela, and we're going to therefore say the following. Then when do we require edus bifnei baldin? That's called amotzi mechavila, right? I want to take money out of your pocket. I want to sue you for damages. I want you to take money out of your bank account and transfer it into my bank account. Then the answer is that the nidon, the nitba, has to be there at the time of the edus. However, if I'm not taking money out of your bank account because what you're holding on to is an object that's a chefetz hagazul, which means that how did you inherit it? Well, it was part of the estate. Yeah, it's part of the estate as far as chazak is concerned if your father has a chazak on it. But if it's an object that was stolen, then there is no chazak. And if there's no chazak, the Yorish has no rights here to claim I'm a muhsak and wait till I become a gadol in order to testify against me. But in any event, Rabbo said, let's just summarize three different approaches to the sugya of sumchus. The premise of all three, and that's what's common, is that sumchus embraces, like the chachamim, the requirement of bifnei baldin. He doesn't deny that when the Torah says, well, who had bibolov, it's got to be bifnei baldin. Why then does Sumchus allow the Nigzal to subpoena two Edom into Bezdin to testify against the Katan? The halacha is that a Katan is not considered a Baldin. And we have three answers to that question. The first answer to that question is what we saw in the name of Rashi and Tosfos, that Sumchus holds that there are extenuating circumstances under which we can in fact validate Edom Shelo Bifnei Baldin. And we gave a number of cases. Either the nitba is on the other side of the earth, the nitba is sick in a sick bed, he's laid up in a hospital, we can't get him into bed. So we're going to waive the requirement of Fnei Baldin. The cotton can't be considered a Baldin, we waive that requirement. The second pshat is going to be that of the Nebuki Yosef. The Nebuki Yosef is going to say, no, what we have here is an entirely different halacha. And that is that What we need in Simchas's frame of reference is the following. We need what's called Eidus Haru'uya Lios Bifnei Baldin. And all those exceptional cases to the rule are technical and they present barriers to bring the Baldin into Bezdin. But if Alpidin, the Baldin could not possibly be a Baldin because a Katan doesn't have the status of a Baldin, in such a case, the Eidus has to be completely nulled and voided. And therefore, when the Rashba says, wait, I don't understand, why are the Chachamim insisting that, I'm sorry, why is Sumchus insisting that we cannot get the Gzela out of the hands of the Katan because Ein Mekablim Eidus El Bifnei Baldover, why not consider this as an exception to the rule? Says Nebuki Yosef, no. All the other exceptions to the rule are technical in nature. This is a halachic legal exception to the rule. Then we move on finally to the Rush. And the Rush insists that there's a separate halach in Gzela, that in Gzela, according to the Chachamim, we're going to alleviate the requirement of Bifnei Baldin, and Sukkos never accepted that exception. Now the Gemara wants to know about a certain halacha of the Chacham. So again, if you're tuning in now, we're on Daf Kuf Yud Beis Amud Aleph, and we're up to Bar Chamua de Rebbe Yirmi, a whole Gansa Maisa, a whole sad story here about two brothers-in-law. Okay. Now, what we're talking about here is one brother-in-law that is older, and he married into a certain family, and he claims that his possessions, or one of his possessions, was in the hands of his wife's family, which means in the hands of his, as we call it so lovingly, his shver. Okay? Now, unfortunately, the shver dies, and he leaves a young child. This young child is a brother-in-law, in this particular case, to Rabbi Yirmiyah. Rabbi Yirmiyah is one of the Gedolei Ador, and he's claiming that amongst the possessions in this estate of my father-in-law is something that belongs to me, whatever it might be. You know, there's a field that really belongs to me. Maybe it was part of the agreement when he got married. I don't know. And what happens? The Katan, insofar as he's a big shot, if I ever meet this guy, I'm telling you, you know, sometimes I get more angry at children who are, you know, chutzpin yaks, you know what I mean? They're I don't want to use all the, you know, all the different colloquials, you know, the idiomatic phrases we have for these punks. Anyway, so he decides that he's locking up the field, locking up the house, and he doesn't allow Rabbi Yirmiyah to come and claim that which is his. And that's what the Gemara tells us. Bar Chamua de Rabbi Yirmiyah, the son of the father-in-law of Rabbi Yirmiyah, after the father-in-law dies, Tarak means to lock, Gale means the doors, Bi'ape de Rabbi Yirmiyah, in the face of Rabbi Yirmiyah, so to speak, meaning he blocked Rabbi Yirmiyah's access to the house. Rabbi Yirmiyah, on the other hand, wanted him to take that which is his, which is rightfully his, and take possession of the house or whatever was in the house. And the Katan doesn't want to let him go near the house. You know, he sets up lions around the house, you know, say he has shomrim, you know. This Katan, you know, he's a real tough kid, this kid. Okay? When he gets older, he'll be a Ramatkal. You know, we need these type of tough guys, right? Now, Rabbi Yirmiyah has no recourse here in this situation because he's locked out of what he claims is his own house. Also, he comes to the Beis Din of Rabbi Ovin, And he thinks that Rabbi Ovin is going to issue some sort of an injunction, a court order, to allow Rabbi Yirmiyah possession, access to his own possession, that which is rightfully his. But the only problem is that when you go to a Beis Din, you need witnesses, you need to adduce evidence, there's going to be a court case. You know, with all due respect to Rabbi Yirmiyah, he could be the Gadol HaDor himself, but he just can't issue as a one man show, you know, force the Beis Din to issue some sort of injunction on his favor. So Amar lo, Rabbi Ovin says to Rabbi Yirmiyah, Shelo hu tovea, this child has a right to claim that which is his. Now who says it belongs to you? And therefore the child has a right to lock you out. Amale, so Rabbi Yirmiyah turns to Rabbi Ovin, and he says, okay, you know what? This child has a right to the estate of his father. And whatever his father possessed in his lifetime, with his death, the son inherits it. But this house does not belong to my shver, it belongs to me. So this child has no rights of inheritance for the estate that's mine and not his father's. V'hamaisino asadi. And if you don't believe me, Rabbi Ovin, I'm going to bring my witnesses to testify on my behalf. Now, why is he bringing witnesses? Apparently he has no... Well, what's the classical method of proving your ownership on a piece of karka? Classic. Shtar. In the absence of a shtar, you bring witnesses. Now, did the Edim actually see the shtar? I don't know. But what did the Edim see? So this is the third parak of Bava Kama. What's that called? Of Babas, I'm sorry. It's called Cheskas Habat. That's called 3 years. The Achzuke Bey Bechayavuha, that during the lifetime of the father, meaning my father-in-law, I was living in the field and working the field, enjoying the benefits of the field. I exploited the field in every normal way. That's called Cheskas Gimel Shonim. Now notice, there's one condition here. He has to say Bechayavuha, because the child that we're talking about is less than bar mitzvah. There's no such thing as a chazaka b'chaye yitomim if they're ketanim. So the we have to add that proviso that the Edom are testifying on 3 years of achila, of achilas peros during the lifetime of the father. And obviously the father-in-law made no protest. There was no mecha. Oh, so now the case of Rabbi Yirmiyah stands or falls on what? On Edim. Amal Leser of Ovin says to him, V'chi mekablim Edim shelo bifnei baldin. I have a feeling that Rabbi Ovin looked at Rabbi Yuri and says, like, what school did you go to? You know, are you a total Amoritz? You don't know that the basic halach that we need bifnei baldin. And a katan, of course, is not a baldin, because he's a katan. So it's become shelo bifanov. Like, What are you thinking, Rabbi Yirmiyah? What claim do you think you have? And the Gemara later on is going to dash in this from Shor Amur. So Rabbi Yirmiyah says, "Velo, are you telling me that in the case of Gzela, the Nigzal has no recourse to bring Edim, even against the Katan? Meaning if this Katan, in quotation marks, you know, inherited a stolen piece of property, so the Nigzal has to wait until he becomes a Gadol Vaktani." We have the Brisa that we just learned in the name of the Chachamim, Bein Gedolim, Bein Ktanim, Chayovim. That even though, as a universal rule, it's Shalom Bifnei Baldin is not acceptable, but in this case, it is acceptable. Let's say if we go with the Nemuki Yosef, you know, there's an exception that, what was the Nemuki Yosef again? Because, I don't know, the Nemuki Yosef was explaining Sukkah, sorry. Well, let's go with the Rush, just to make life easier for ourselves, that there's a separate din in Gzela, that the Nigzal has rights to get his Gzela back even from a katan by testifying in front of Beis Din. Amale, I've news for you, says Rabbi Yochanan. Bad news for you. Hare machlokas sumchus bitzidcha. You know, sumchus in that very same braisa, bitzidcha, meaning right next to chachamim, disagrees with the chachamim. And according to sumchus, even in the case of ktanim, even in the case of gzela, the rule, the hardcore rule of ein makablim eid shalom fnei baldin applies. And at this point, Rabbi Yirmiyah is, you know, he's losing it. You know, he's like falling apart. We're quoting Sumchus. Who cares about Sumchus? With all due respect. He says, Omar, Rabbi Yirmiyah says, Ichpal kule alma. Ichpal means the whole world is toreach. You know, they work hard. V'koy kis Sumchus, to prove that we paskin like Sumchus. We have a rule, that yachid v'rabim, halacha k'rabim. And Rabbi Yirmiyah makes a certain cynical comment over here. You know why everyone's working here to paskin like Sumchus against the Chachamim? Lafkuan b'lididi? Because they have something against me? Obviously we should paskin like the Chachamim. And if we paskin like the Chachamim, we are able to accept Edus Shalob, in this case in front of the Ketanim. Adahachi Igalgel Milsa V'asa Umato Lekami D'Ravi Avo. So in the meantime, I guess it came to the attention of Rabbi Avo. Okay, so now let's see what Rabbi Avo has to say. Omar, so this is Rabbi Avo talking now. Lo Shmia Lechu Had Rav Yosef Bar Chomam Rav Oshia. Do you not know the statement of Rav Oshia? The Omar Rav Yosef Bar Chomam Rav Oshia Tinok. Shetokaf be'avodov v'yor l'tov sada shal chavero v'omar shalihu ein omrim namtin ad she yagdil ela motzin miyado miyad u'kshe yagdil yavi edim v'nire. Says Rav Oshia that in a case where, very similar to our case, the child brings, you know, he instructs his avodim to go down to Yenim's field and, you know, seize and usurp the field, claim ownership on the field. We don't say that, you know, in the meantime, the Baal HaSod has to wait until the child becomes a gadol in order to testify against him and get his field back. No. Motzien miyado miyad. Immediately we'll take it out of his hands. This child is a gazlan. And then, if the child has a claim to this field, let him put forth that claim. L'kshe yagdil, he'll bring edim. And then we'll see if he's correct or he's not correct. In other words, in the case of Rabbi Yirmiyah, that's what Rabbi Avo had to say. We should immediately remove the katan from this house, get him out, clear the way for Rabbi Yirmiyah to reclaim that which is his. And then, if this child, when he becomes a gadol, can bring edim to adduce evidence that the house is his, fine. But in the meantime, motzien miyado miyat, which seems to indicate clearly that we paskin like the chachamim against sumchus, and we can't accept edim against the ketanim in this case of gzela. Says the Gemara, midami, that's not a valid comparison. Why not? Hasamhu demafkina mine, there in the case of Rav Oshia, why do we take it out of his hands? Delo kaimale achazoka de avua. He didn't inherit this land. It was not in the possession of his father. And if it's not part of the estate, then when he sends his avodim to confiscate someone else's karka, that's a maisik zela. Aval hacha or hecha de isle chazoka de avua, if the Yarshim are inheriting the estate of the father, and that includes everything in the estate, lo, then we can't take the katan out of the estate and say, well, you know what? We're going to bring Edus against you and force you to give over your possession to Rabbi Yirmiyah. And basically what the Gemara is coming down to here is a new halach in Yerusha, that a Yoresh, not like I wanted to say before, if you heard my svara, is considered a muchzak by virtue of the fact that he's a yoresh. It's almost as if the yoresh is like his father. He's an extension. Remember, we once had a machlokas where the yoresh is kelokeach domi or not kelokeach domi. We had one svara to say that the yoresh steps into the feet of his father. His father had a chazaka. Somebody claims, well, that's stolen. The burden of the proof is on the nigzal, who the plaintiff who insists that the defendant is holding on to my stolen property. Until that point, we don't have any claim against him. Just one more sentence, just before I lose it. Is therefore, as soon as the father dies, the Yerusha automatically gives to the, how do you say in English, ma'aniklo, it bequeaths, I don't know, whatever the word is, bequeaths to the Yarshim all the rights of the father. And just like the father has a right to say, well, you're claiming it's a stolen piece of property, I have possession of it, I'm otzi mechavel of a raya, bring edim against me that indeed it's yours and not mine. And in the absence of edus, we have aloch of chazaka. And therefore, the Yarshim slip into the status of their father. And they also could say that, you know what? I inherited that chazaka from my father. And you want to undermine my chazaka and, you know, like to remove the bottle cork from the thing, then the proof is on you, the burden of proof. And therefore, you have to bring edim to take it out of my hand. So that this little whatever, you know, son is in the right over here. Why? He's blocking Reviria out. Why do we give him a gold medal for doing that? Because he's the Yoresh. And he's the Yoresh, he becomes a Muchzak. Why is he a Muchzak? Because his father was a Muchzak. Ah, the Nigzal's claiming there was no valid chazon because he stole it from me. Okay, for that you have to deuce testimony. But when did Rav Hoshea say that we can allow the Edom to testify against the Katan? That's only if the Katan did a bold, brazen act of Takavis Chaveru of Gzela. He didn't inherit this property. He was never in the possession of his father. Yeah, good.
Have a minute to compare the two cases. It seems so simple and such a chiluk between it.
So that the svara that I said before, I don't know if you heard it, was the following: that you can claim chazaka as a yoresh by inheriting something from your father up until a certain point.
But he's not a yoresh; he claims it was his father.
Right. So I'm saying I'm trying to understand Rabbi Yirmiyah. Rabbi Yirmiyah is looking at this brother-in-law of his, this youngster, and he's saying to him, "You're a gazlan. You have no right to establish a chazaka. Ah, you inherited this piece of property from your father. The property was mine." In other words, the machlokas here between Rabbi Yirmiyah and Rabbi Ovin, right, the first Dayan, is the following. Rabbi Yirmiyah claims that the laws of Yerusha cannot apply to a chefetz hanigzal. I'm going to prove that this object which this little youngster is claiming is his and he has a chazaka is not his. Why? Because it was never included in the Yerusha. Comes along the Gemara at the end here in the name of Rabbi Avo and says, Rabbi Yirmiyah made one mistake. The law is that if there's possession... Okay. Now here, Abosai, we have a problem. I don't know if I have time for this problem. I'm just going to mention it to you. Maybe next week, if you want, we can get into it. There's a fundamental difference in terms of possession between karka and metaltal. In the case of metaltalin, there's such a thing called tfisa. Possession in the literal sense. That doesn't apply to karka. Who's considered the muhsak in karka? Tomorrow come? Correct, the Marakama. Not Cheskas Tfisa, but Cheskas Marakama. So that, what is this child claiming here? He locks out Rav Yirmiyah from a bias. A bias is what? Karka. And he's claiming that he's the Muchzak. How can he claim he's the Muchzak?
No, he's claiming he's a Yorish.
Yeah, even if he's a Yoresh, but what gives him Chazaka? Again, Rabbi Yirmiyah's argument was, what do you mean you're a Yoresh? It's mine. You can't be a Yoresh, I'm mine. The answer is, but I'm Muchzak. That makes sense in the case of Metaltalin. Then he can claim the Yoresh that he's a Muchzak. By the way, this question is not mine. All the Rishonim have asked this question. So if you want to fight with me, you're going to have to face the firing squad here, the Rishonim. The Rishonim want to know, how does this halacha, this principle that a Yorish becomes a Muchzak, and if he's a Katan, you're going to have to wait till he's a Gadol, until you can testify against him because it's a Motzi Mecha. How does that kick in the case of Rabbi Yirmiyah? The case of Rabbi Yirmiyah is a case of Karka.
We understood the sugya slightly different. We thought that Rabbi Yirmiyah was was living in the house, and he was muhzak.
That also is an issue in this sugya. There are different rishonim.
And he was muhzak, and the katan is coming. You were living in my father's house. But
so again, if there's a cheskas tfisa in karkos, if there is such a concept, which again is gigantic, complicated sugya. But if there is such a parallel, just like in metaltal is tfisa, so too in karkos is tfisa, then it could be very possible that even though Reb Yirmiyahu was there, since it's part of the Yerusha, his father-in-law maybe has a cheskas tfisa. Yeah. That's the whole issue here. Who's the motzi and who's the muhzak? All right.
But to get back to the basic question.
Yeah.
In Reb Yirmiyahu's case, there was a chazaka. The question was it a good chazaka or not?
But correct.
There was raglayim ledavar. There was a chazaka.
Well, not here, really, because case, again, he has two edim in his back pocket.
So that's the question. The question is it a good chazaka?
So Rav Yirmiyahu is saying that it's not
here,
a good chazaka.
Here, there's not even any chazaka.
That's what I'm saying. Rav Yirmiyahu say here also there's no chazaka. Why? Because there's no tfisa in karkos. I'm the marakama. He wants to claim it's his. It's stolen property. There's no Yerushan stolen property.
So that's the question. That's what they are looking
for. Yeah. Oh, I'm saying. But you hear Rav Yirmiyahu's taina. It's a very good taina. Omar Rav Ashi, Omar Rav Shabtai. Mekablim Edim Shelo Bifnei Baldin. Obviously, it's a shakaru. We know that that's not so. It's Toibo Rav Yochanan. Rav Yochanan says, what's going on over here? Rav Shabtai doesn't know a basic halacha. Every cheder yingle knows this, right? V'chimakavlim edim shelo b'fnei baldin. Comes along Rav Yossi, Rav Chanina, kibla minei Rav Yossi, Rav Chanina. He heard this question of Rav Yochanan, and he also heard from Rav Yochanan himself an interpretation or an answer to this question. What was Rav Shabtai talking about? Was he making a mistake over here? This is black and white. This is what we call Tav Bidvar Mishnah. Kigon Shehu Chole O Edov Cholim O Shehoyu Edim Edov Mevakshim Lelech Limedinas Hayam. And then it says Vesholchu Lo V'lo Ba. Okay. Now, exactly how to interpret those last few words, v'sholchu lo v'lo ba, is the subject of this Tosfos here, Dibra Maschil v'sholchu lo. But before we get to that, let's just take a step back and look at the first part of this Braisa, which is 80% of the Braisa. He's got here three scenarios in which we will allow, and we'll overlook this requirement, of b'fnei bezdin, and allow the Edom to testify shalom b'fnei baldin. Shelo b'fnei baldin. Now, let's just, if we can, skip to the second and third cases, and then we'll get back to the first case. In the second case, it says Edov Cholim. So Rashi and Tosfos understand that Cholim here doesn't mean that they have a cold, or even how do you say in English, angina?
Angina.
Well, no, when you take when you take antibiotics, what's it called? I'm blanking out over here. When you take a throat culture, what's that called?
Strep.
We're not talking about a cold. We're not even talking about strep. We're talking about a chole who's al eres dvai lo aleinu. He's hovering between this one and the next. And in such a case, if the Edom die, then obviously the Baldin, the Tovei, the plaintiff has no recourse to get his. So right now the Baldin is not around for questioning, so we can't testify in front of him. So what's the other option? That the Edom Nebuchadnezzar are going to go to their world, and then there's no possibility. So in such a case, we waive the requirement of Bifnei Baldin. What's the third scenario? Oshayu Edim Avakshim Lelech Limedina Sayam. And we don't know if they're ever going to come back. You know, it's not like today where you can go around the world in, 25 hours. You know, you end up in Australia and you left on a Sunday and you arrived on Shabbos. You know, so now it's complicated. Oh, now, what's the first case? The first case is Kegon Shahoya Hu Chole. Huchol, you know, I have a disdain for pronouns because they always confuse me. I wish we had a language without pronouns. What does the word who mean here? Who is who? You know what I mean? In two different languages. Okay. So this is going to be a major machlokes in the Rishonim between the Rosh and the Riva. And according to one opinion, it's the Tovea that's a chole. And he's worried about his future heirs. And there's a, let's say, to dramatize, there's a very significant amount of money at stake. And if he dies, then, you know, who's going to carry the ball here? The Yarshim are too young, or whatever it might be, to go into Beis Din and sue for the monies that are coming to him. So it's really a the 11th hour. You know, he's got to testify. If he doesn't get the testimony in now, he may go on to the next world. The other pshat here is that the nitba, the defendant, in whose presence we need the edus to take place, he himself is a chola, and he's hovering here between life and death. Now, the first interpretation is accepted by the Riva and quoted by the Rosh. The Rosh has the second interpretation, but he quotes the Riva, and he writes that, why do I insist that it's the Tovea who's a chole? He says, "Kshanitba chole, ein mekablin es ha'edus." In other words, the Riva understands that when the Torah requires the Nitba to be there, the Torah is going out on a limb on behalf of the Nitba. It's like, you know, when the Mets came to play in New York, I became a Met fan because never the Mets, you know, they couldn't put their act together. Years later, they won the World Series. But at that point, you know, so the Nitba is the underdog, so to speak. So we have to, you know, our compassion goes out for the underdog to try to protect his interests. And therefore, we require, as an absolute requirement, says the Riva, that he be there for the Eidus. If he's a Chole, that's the Tovea's tough luck. The Rosh doesn't understand it that way. The Rosh understands that this is Halach and Eidus, and it applies equally to both the Tovea and the Nitba. And therefore, if either one of them is ill, and the case may go down the tubes into the burial plot, then we're going to suspend the rule of Bifnei Baldin. Okay, now what's the subject of this Tosfos, Divrei Maskil V'Sholchu? It's that last line in the statement of who is it again who's explaining Rav Shabtai, Rav Yosef Rav Chanina. And in his last statement, he says that Sholchu lo v'lo ba. Now here in this case, the pronoun is clear. The word lo certainly refers to whom? The nitba, to the defendant. Is that clear? Nobody has any problems with that, I hope, right? The nitba was subpoenaed in front of Beis Din by the Tovea, and he refuses to show up. This is mice in today's world, as you all know, this is mice in b'chol yom. Especially in the rabbinic courts, I have to tell you. I shouldn't add that comment because... But this is the main problem. The nitba says, go fly kite, I'm not showing up to Beis Din. So imagine... The Tovea has no recourse to get his Edom to testify because this guy refuses to come. What's it called in English? A recluse? There's a fancy name for it. I have to ask the lawyers, okay? In any event...
Contempt.
Yeah, it's like contempt of court. Oh. So in this case, we're going to go ahead without the Nitba. If he refuses to show up to Beis Din, we're going to see later on that there are various exceptions in which the Nitba has a right to say, I don't want to show up, I want to take it to a higher court, etc., etc. But now, that's not what's going on. The Nitba is just simply refusing to show up. Okay. Now, if you flip the page I gave you to the other side, again, I think you may have to flip the whole thing. Oh, okay, you... Right? So do you see a number Yud Gimel on the left side of your page? So he quotes here another interpretation in the name of the Rosh, and he says, Shebehem shechasu yinire, shebezeh sheshalchu lo v'lo ba, levad dai b'chdei sheyikablu eidus shelo b'fanav. That this last statement stands on its own. Meaning, by virtue of the fact that the Nitba refuses to show up in Beis Din, that justifies waiving the requirement of Bifan. Okay? However, Tosfos here, Dibra Maskel v'Sholchulo, does not accept the Rush. Good catch. And he says the following. It doesn't say, oh, Sholchu. If you notice, the first three cases are always separated one from the other with the word, oh. In the last case, it doesn't say the word, oh. And it means that the last case is an addendum to all the other cases. Ein zeh mikra b'fnei atzmo. This is at the beginning of footnote Yud Gimel. El shebechol echad me'am mikrim aniskarim shayachole o shayedim hayu cholim o shayachol medina sadiyam, etc. They're about to check out to the long boat to China. In all these cases, tzarech gam sheyishlach lo v'lo ba. So according to this interpretation, and again, it all depends on whether you have the gears of O or you don't have the gears. We don't have the gears of O, says Tosfos. In all the previous exceptional cases, they're all conditional on a second condition. You have to check off two boxes. Number one, it's a shas adchak. And number two, the nitba refuses to show up. And at this point, the Rush has zero tolerance for this Tosfos and this gears. He says it can't be. Why do we need two conditions? Each condition is independent to the other one. If there's an urgency and there's no possibility of waiting for the nitba, then let the eidim testify. If, on the other hand, the nitba, there's no urgency, but the nitba refuses to show up in Beis Din, then that is itself license for accepting the eidim shelo b'fanav. But what I really wanted to do with you today, and we'll see if we can fit it in the 5 minutes that we have, is footnote number Yudalit. In the name of the Rashba. So let's just for a moment go back to the Gemara. And the Gemara said the following, Vishalchu lo v'lo ba, which if we assume like the Rush means this is a fourth exception to the rule of Shalom b'fanav. And in all these cases, the Chachamim waived the requirement of Eidus b'fnei baldin. Says the Rashba, why? Why should we waive that requirement? If the Torah requires b'fnei bal din, there's nothing to do about it. My heart goes out for the Tovah. But what can we do? The Torah says, v'hu ad b'balav. Says the Rashba. If this had been dinei nefashos, dinei nechinami, we cannot accept the Eidim. Why do we have these exceptional rules and all of a sudden we're flexible? The answer is because our discussion here is about dinei momonos. And where did the Torah require b'fanav? That's only in the case of dinei nefashos. The requirement of b'fanav vis-a-vis dinei momonos is a rabbinic institution. And that's why we can be flexible. The Rabbanan are willing to stretch the law a little bit on behalf of the Toveya because of the urgency of the situation, but only because hey mamru. They themselves created this requirement to be fun of. They can be lax about it and waive that requirement. Maybe it's hefker bez and hefker. I don't know. When you say hefker bez and hefker, I don't even think you have to come on to that because it's hey mamru, meaning there was never a Torah requirement of b'fanav. The Rabbanan said, under these circumstances, there's such a requirement. They created that requirement. I don't even need efker bez nefker. Oh. So he says the following. The Rashba, in addition to writing chidushim on the Masechta, he wrote a tshuva. That's called Tshuvas HaRashba. I'm the proud owner of all the volumes of the Tshuvas HaRashba. 7 volumes that were published in Italy about 4 centuries ago. Baruch Hashem, I collected them and now I have the whole set. I'm very proud of the Tshuvas HaRashba. Okay. And he says the following, that ein chiluk ubechol makom sheyesh tzorech makavlim. He says the following, that we're not going to distinguish, as opposed to what I wrote in my Chidushim, between dinei momonos and dinei nefashos. It's all a matter of the need of the hour. And if the need of the hour is pressing, the Eidim are going to Medina Sayyam where they're sick on their bed, even in Dinei Nefashos, we're going to allow the Eidim to testify, even though the so-called Rotzeach, meaning the Jacques, is nowhere to be found. We're going to flex, we're going to alleviate that requirement. And he writes that Dinei Momonos is derived from the same pasuk as Dinei Nefashos, again, against the very premise of he himself, the Rashba, in Chidushim. And therefore, if the Gemara is now willing to be lenient here in the name of Rabbi Yossi, then that leniency applies equally to both Dini Nefashis and Dini Mamonis, because there's no difference between the two. And they're both requirements midoraisa. Yisdach Rabosai, I think we have, for those who enjoy a little bit of lumdus, a little bit of Derech HaLimud, a fantastic example of the following structure. When the Torah adds a requirement, how do we understand that requirement? Is it absolute? It defines the nature of the halachic action, or is it a condition? If it's a condition, then the condition only applies when it's possible to fulfill the condition. You can only require of a ger, to bring his karbon when the Beis Hamikdash stands. But today, that we don't have a Beis Hamikdash, we'll accept the ger without his karbon. But if we're defining the very maisa, in this case, edus, that's an absolute requirement. There's no room for flexibility. So, for example, if I take the Rashba in Chidushim here af in Art, in Dinei Nefashos, we have an absolute requirement of Befanov. That defines the essence of Eidus. And without Befanov, I don't care what the circumstances are, it's not Eidus. On the other hand, according to the Rashba in Chuvis, the requirement of Befanov is only a Tanai. It's a condition. When does the Torah impose that condition? When it's feasible to fulfill that condition. But when it's impossible to fulfill the condition, then we drop the condition and the requirement goes down the timayon. Ubichidushe Rabbi Kiva Eger, Tama Bestiras Dvarav. He doesn't understand how the Rashba could contradict himself from his chidushim to his tshuvas and not blink a word about it. Okay. What time is it now? Okay, it's time for Mincha?
Yeah.
All right. So we'll stop here.